Hello and welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb, and today I am joined by my father, Dr. Scott Keith. We have Adam Francisco back in the studio.
What the heck?
A miracle.
It is.
And then we have two guests with us today. We have Ed Killian, who has famously been on the show two or three times before.
Infamously,
because it was one of the episodes where Caleb was missing, which is like only three episodes. And editing that episode was one of the biggest nightmares of my life because my dad recorded it.
We were a little out of control. Yeah.
And then we have...
I think he was more alluding to my audio technical skills.
Oh, yeah, his tech skills are horrible.
Oh. Got it.
And then we have David Anderson on the show today as well, who has... you've been on the show one other time. You were here...
I think we did two.
Did we do two episodes that day?
Yep.
I think we did. Okay. And you were on because you had recently published a book with us last time, and then I think we also did just an episode about the postscript on happiness in there.
We did.
And today, you're back. You're on vacation, but you just published another book with 1517.
I'm on vacation.
Called In Defense of Christian Ritual, and the Case for a Biblical Pattern of Worship, available at shop.1517.org. And on Amazon and probably a couple other places. I'll put the two big links in the show notes. Again, that's In Defense of Christian Ritual. And that means we're going to talk about the topic of the book, which is ritual. And you make a couple claims in here. Number one, that ritual is useful for Christians. Number two, that everybody has rituals. And I guess the conclusion between those two is that there are some rituals that are good. There's some that are bad. And here's a case for a set of rituals in particular which maintain the gospel and its centrality.
Yes.
Right? Is that about?
Yep. Basically, I'm saying that there's a biblically mandated set of rituals within which the gospel is proclaimed and that we would do best to follow.
Right. And that's in contrast to alternatives or removal of those in some cases, but then even of the setting up of new rituals, different rituals, maybe even secular rituals. And so that's probably a good place to start. In the book, you talk about a shifting culture, which in one respect looks at formal religious ritual and kind of poo-poos it and says, go away, but establishes its own sets of ritual. It doesn't become ritual free, right? It's not a liberation to just say, I'm getting rid of religion.
Right, right. I mean, popular American religion eschews ritual, at least they think they do. And in fact, I think they even demean it. But the joke is everybody's doing some order of worship, right? That's some ritual to some degree.
Yeah.
I'm simply arguing that there is a biblical pattern of worship that comes through very clearly, not only in the Old Testament, but in the New Testament, and shows up in the early church as well.
I think this is a conversation that we used to have quite a bit. And I remember sort of back when the church growth movement was, I think, probably more of a thing than it is now. I could be naive on this. It could be a huge thing still. within the LCMS... And I remember saying that quite a bit. The argument always was, why are you guys doing this thing that's so old and not changed, and it seems like the world has changed and everything else has changed? Why have the way you guys worship, why is it still the same? Why not just sort of worship, just let the Spirit lead you type stuff? And it was always pretty easy if you attended as a guest one of these services where the Spirit was just leading, that there was something going on that was pretty common from worship service to worship service to worship service. And the sort of the funniest parody of that I ever saw was that Contemporvent video that was circling around a couple of years ago, where they basically showed sort of the modern Christian evangelical worship, and it was, you know, somebody telling a story and then sort of showing their past and their tattoos, and then quietly praying so that the worship band could come on and the worship band. And it was a parody, but it was very good at showing what you just said, that everybody, especially when it's in the context of a worship service, has ritual. The question is, I think, or maybe a couple questions, why do you use the rituals that you do? Why do you rely on them? And are they sort of good or bad? And by good or bad, I guess I'd mean biblical or not biblical. You know, I do want to get to, though, I'll let you answer that, but I have another question. I have a follow-up after that.
Okay. Well, one thing I wanted to say was, since the 19th century revivalists came on the scene in Cambridge, Kentucky, 1801, they changed the pattern of worship to three steps: warm up singing, the message, and what they refer to as conversion. This is still what most evangelicals do today. I mean, nothing has changed. And you're right. This is they went from the traditional liturgy, which was what I refer to as word and table in the book, namely the first part of the service is centered around the reading and hearing of Scripture. The second part is centered around the Lord's Supper, which was, you know, essentially the pinnacle of the service to the historic Christians. That's basically what churches are still doing. That nothing has really changed much. And even though whatever is new is always to be preferred, nothing has really changed.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, the funny thing about, you know, you mentioned that contemporary event video where it even shows that things like, well, people would ask you, why do you sing these hymns in between the pacing of a service in a traditional liturgy, saying prayers places? You know, you can answer with certain purpose-driven things because of the division, moving from things like confession, absolution, to reading, mm-hmm. to proclamation of the word, to the supper. The parts of the in-between parts, prayers and songs and hymns and psalms, move you through that. You know, that's still, even that's being replaced, but for different reasons. We're going to do a particular prayer here that has to be a particular length. Why? Because we need to get, you know, 10 people on stage.
Yeah.
That's even got a purpose. It's not just,
oh, wow.
It's not just, you know, nice. Extemporaneous prayer for the sake of making a prayer 5 minutes. No, you need 5 minutes to get people behind the drums again, to get amps turned on, to do level checks. So there's, you know, there's reasons why you do things, whether it's old or new.
Yeah.
Right. One of the points I make in the book is that I think more than anything now we're about entertainment. And, you know, we want to be entertained wherever we go. We want to be entertained when we watch TV. And it's common to hear from stages nowadays in bigger churches that church shouldn't be boring, right? I don't even know what that means, that church shouldn't be boring. But
there's a movie theater in Big Bear, and the guy must be, you know, some pious evangelical of some sort who owns it, because before movies play, there's a commercial for every church in Big Bear that wants to have a slide at the beginning.
Oh, interesting.
And the whatever the big non-denominational one is down at, by the lake, their slogan is literally like, church can be fun. And it's got a pastor making big arms and a huge smile. And you're like, mm-hmm. I don't even know what does that communicate?
Well, I think it's a heavy burden for if you're a pastor. That if the requirement is that you be uber entertaining every weekend, that's probably not what most of our guys were taught at seminary. Between theology classes, you know, okay, this is how you be really entertaining too in the middle of that. And I think that's got to be a heavy burden if that's sort of the bar.
Well, and there's a difference between dynamic, captivating speech, which is actually one of the, you know, the pinnacle shifts in the Reformation with a focus on rhetoric, and even Melanchthon and Luther's praise of Cicero and teaching rhetoric at the university and teaching people how to speak and how to deliver a sermon. But that found a ministerial use in making the proclamation of the word clear to people in a way that they can understand, memorize, take hold of.
Yeah.
That's different than conforming the word for the sake of the end goal being entertainment.
Yeah, and in the first part of the book, one thing I talk about is the shift from a print-based culture to a television culture. And we above all, want to be entertained. I mean, emotional gratification is really the end-all and be-all of everything these days.
Don't take away my wicked tuna, man.
It's a TV show. Cultural reference, sorry.
Yeah, I didn't get that one either.
We didn't mean to throw that at you.
Can I throw a little anecdote in here?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
I probably shouldn't admit this on the air or whatever this is that we're doing.
He's been in it six years, but it's on the air or something like that.
So probably 20 years ago, no, more than 20 years ago, I attended a Winds of Worship conference in Anaheim, California at the Vineyard. church. Where
I remember the vineyard.
John Wimber was still alive and was there. And I remember sitting through a seminar. Back then, I thought I could play guitar. I aspired to be a worship leader and these sorts of things in the charismatic sort of evangelical movement. And sat through a couple seminars where they talked about music theory and what sort of, I guess it's scales you work in to elicit certain emotions.
Yeah.
To prepare.
Emotive playing.
Well, to prepare for that end, that altar call.
Yeah.
It would, in a way, facilitate the moving of the Holy Spirit. I remember sitting there thinking, oh, this is a little odd. That was sort of as I was transitioning out of that. But
you know, that's funny. Yeah.
Dan Price's story.
Oh yeah,
he was a pretty big like worship leader. Like he would get hired at massive churches all over the country to come play. And he said he would get people come up to him after church every Sunday and say, "Oh, I could really tell the Spirit was moving you." And he's telling himself, "No, man, it's not the Spirit. I just know what to play to get you to feel a certain way."
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
That my venture into agnosticism began that way when I noticed my non-denom pastor towards the end of his sermon reach behind him and subtly kind of flip his hand, and all of a sudden the light slowly came down and the music slowly came up, and I thought, oh my gosh, I've seen behind the curtain and the wizard is
literally
fake, you know.
Yeah
I mean it was kind of devastating to me.
Oh, and I guess so. One of the points that I pull out of the book, and I think is in general true here, is that some of this is, and then specifically in the cases of the stories just told, is some sort of way of divining knowledge or effect from God through worship, through music, trying to get the Holy Spirit there, and this is all sort of like a speculative approach to how to get God. It looks sort of at the world, it looks at the way people emote and things like that, and comes at a conclusion about how we can best, you know, get God to work personally for these people. In contrast to that, we actually have a word of God, a promise from God that says, this is how I send my Spirit. These are fixed means that I have put in place here. And so you don't have to divine me out of the music. You don't have to, you know, invite me into the service.
Divine me out of your heart.
Right, divine me out of the heart. I am located here, and that's in word and sacrament.
Exactly. One of the points that I make here, and this is a point that was brought up by Gordon Lathrop, he basically makes the point that modern religion is really closer to Gnosticism than it is to Christianity. Mm. Gnosticism is this ancient heresy that said that truth lies within. They denigrated the body. They didn't think that... They denied everything we think about.
Material's bad.
Christ.
Spiritual's good.
Right. And our culture that views going to church like it does view going to a shopping mall type of experience, right, is really more Gnostic than it is Christian.
Well, even some of the high church Neoplatonist response too does this as well, where church is about sort of participating out there in the ether and tries to use, say, higher vestments or different types of services to also elicit emotions with people so that they come to experience God rather than using the divine service to deliver God and his means and his goods.
Sure. Although I would argue, I'd be one to suggest that I think liturgy should be done beautifully. That was a chapter that it didn't make it into the book. I got tired. But but that would be an interesting one as well. I think liturgy should be done well.
Is there a difference between doing it well and doing it uber fancy?
I guess that's a matter of taste. I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah, because that's been my argument on that for a long time, is that people on some of the questions that we get on this have said, oh, Dr. Keith is anti-liturgical. And I've always been kind of surprised at that because I've literally never belonged to a church that wasn't running either 5 and 15 every Sunday or one of the divine services out of LSB. But I've never made the argument, I've never made a high church argument, because I think that there's a distinction between arguing for a service that is liturgical and focused on essentially word and sacrament. Oliver Olson wrote a great book on worship where he sort of nails out, I guess, like five chief parts to worship. having to do with, I don't remember them all off the top of my head, but with readings and sacraments and invocation and benediction and kind of things that you would recognize as, you know, the creeds as part of liturgical worship. Mm-hmm. But to me, there's a difference between that and what is, I think, derogatorily been called smells and bells. You know, the wearing chasubles and swinging incense and if 10 candles are good, then 150 must be better type thing. And I'm interested in that discussion because I think that we sometimes lose people there. We sometimes lose people that we could get on the sort of word and sacrament liturgical worship side by seeming too focused on what it looks like. Does that make any sense?
It does. Although I might be on the other end of that, and not that I'm necessarily high church, but I think.
Yeah, you are.
I am high church. thank you. I'm coming out. During this podcast.
I have some chasubles at my place you can use. I'm not using them, so you can put them on.
We can take a picture of a fashion show.
Right. But I don't really deal, by the way, I don't deal with any of this in the book. The book is actually very conservative in its argument. It's just simply arguing that there is a biblical pattern of worship that's found in the word table complex. So I don't even get into whether you should be low or high church or anything. Yeah,
the reason it comes up for
me... Oh, I know,
I'm
asking you, though.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to say, the reason it comes up for me is some... You know, I've had a lot recent experiences with radical orthodoxy, right? The movement, this Anglican movement that's looking to be more Catholic and Platonist. And their services would find... you know, all the parts that we have,
yes,
but maybe even higher. But in their theology and in the point of practice, it is not for the sake of proclamation or delivering absolution or delivering Christ in those elements. It is about a spiritual experience with God. And if you actually boil it down to less academic language, it sounds a lot like evangelical arguments about the experience of worship and where you experience God versus where God actually delivers something to you.
I agree. Although I mean, essentially, I would agree. Although I don't think we can so quickly dispense with experience either. We're not just people who experience things through the mind. We do have emotions, and I don't think that there's any reason why worship shouldn't be beautiful. I mean, if we look at the Old Testament and how worship was prescribed there, this is the same God, right? Between the Old and New Testament. So I'm not sure that it has to be flat and stale,
right?
And it is flat and stale in a lot of churches these days, unfortunately.
Yeah, you and I attended a service together, David, once where the liturgy was sort of conducted almost like a dress rehearsal.
We've all been to churches that they just you can just tell they don't want to be doing it, or at least you feel like that,
or that they've done it in sort of a rote, unemotional way for a very long time.
Yeah.
And that's just sort of how they do it there. Mm-hmm. And it's not, nobody's really thinking about it. No one's really sort of questioning it. It's just, this is the way it's happened. So this is the way that it does happen.
By numbers kind of.
Yeah. I mean, I tell people on the show all the time, back when we were still traveling, I attend a lot of churches each year. Adam does too. And when you're out on sort of the speaking gig circuit, and you know, it's interesting because there are many, many different approaches to this. And, you know, you go to some where it's an LCMS church, but you could swear you're at a vineyard, right? And you go to some and it's a LCMS church and it's sort of that rote, just repeating of a liturgy of some kind. And you go to some and it's, you might think that you're at a
Eastern Orthodox
or a high Anglican kind of service. And it's, at some point I guess one of the things I wanted to ask is, you said right off the bat sort of that there's a mandated ritual. And if you, even within the LCMS, again, if you're going to go around, if you're going to sample 50 churches, I think you'll probably get the idea that it's mostly preference. So what's the mandated part and what's the preferential part?
Well, again, the argument in the book is very conservative. I don't get into those other issues. The only thing I'm suggesting is that both in the New Testament and in the early church, you have a clear pattern of worship that consists of word and sacrament. That's it. That the church has to be, you know, has to center around that word sacrament combination. I don't get into any of this ancillary these ancillary conversations.
So by prescription, then in that case, so that we can, like, so that people who are listening get a clear idea of what that would be things like reading scripture, both Old Testament, New Testament, Psalms, probably singing hymnody of some sort as well pops up, especially if you're using Psalms as hymnody.
Right, right.
And then baptism, Lord's Supper, anything besides?
Baptism is the community-forming event. So yes, it always begins with baptism as it does in Acts 2:41. But in Acts 2:42, immediately they're found in that word sacrament combination as well. You know, they're hearing the teachings of the apostles, and they're breaking bread together, which is which is short for communion in the early church.
So you have within both the main body of the book in a couple places and in the postscript in this one as well, lengthy sections on the problem of sin as it relates to ritual. Could you, give people why does the topic keep coming up throughout the book, and why do you then revisit it at the end of the book as sort of a important stopping point?
Because it's our number one problem, and the funny thing is, I think it's the most obvious problem that human beings have, and it's the thing that we love to deny. And, you know, in our culture, the original sin seems to be denied everywhere, right? But it seems to me to be the easiest thing empirically to establish. But that's our number one issue, and that is what the whole service is about, is dealing with God's holiness and man's sin, right? Our holiness comes from Him and only Him, and that only happens in the in our ritual contact with Him, and that happens in the word table part of the service.
One of the things that popped out at me was that ritual, in even apart from Christian ritual, is in many ways an attempt to deal with the issue of sin. So whether it's leveraging your desires to overcome or deny God, or leveraging the law as it's revealed in nature to try to come to grips with it by some pattern of living or some sort of moral or ethical code, that is sort of the place that ritual is trying to fill. Is that one of the arguments you would be making there?
Yeah, although I do call the point out that we have to distinguish between those man-made rituals that really don't matter and the rituals that were prescribed by Christ, right? And again, what we see clearly in the New Testament is the early church surrounded by the reading and hearing of Scripture and the breaking of bread. It's constant. And we hear this not only in the New Testament, but we hear it, but we see this in our earliest liturgical sources in the second and third centuries.
Hmm. Yeah, so it seems like you have like two options where you can continue to, so the problem between God and man is something that you can philosophize about. You can sort of try to deny or come to grips with, whatever. But the Christian ritual in particular, and the word and sacrament, is an attempt to drive you outside of that, outside of your own mind,
yeah,
and to a word that's actually sort of speaking against that in law and gospel, right? Which drives you to the conclusion that you can actually not climb yourself out of that, and some promise has actually been established instead in the place of an attempt to outdo that.
Right, and from a Lutheran standpoint, we're going to say that we're going to always make the point that the law is what reveals sin, And so you're right. I talk about sin a lot in this book, and I've got an entire postscript on it. But again, it's our number one problem. And where we're going to hear God speaking to us is in that word portion of the service. And the place that we're going to find forgiveness is in the communion portion. Oh, well, you should obviously hear the gospel in the readings as well.
But, oh, maybe in the sermon too.
But yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. I don't.
God willing.
Yeah, God willing. Yeah, you notice I didn't make too big of a thing of that. But yes, during the sermon, one would hope. One would hope, though not always. You would hear the gospel preached. Right. It's a little hit and miss these days.
Which is one of the good arguments for a liturgy that protects the proclamation of the gospel too. Is
right.
That protects you from the pastor having a bad day.
Yes, or you know. From you having a bad pastor, period, right?
Yeah.
One would hope.
Yeah.
Can I ask a question we probably should have asked at the very beginning?
Yeah.
What prompted you to write the book? Why did this case for ritual need to be made? I mean, you've kind of alluded to it already, but
because of popular religion, this was a book written toward popular Christianity, and I just see that it is so subjectively driven, so emotion driven. I thought that it was important to say that no, salvation doesn't lie within. The only thing that lies within is sin and death, and your only hope is outside of yourself in the gospel, in the cross. And in the sacrament. So that's one of the reasons that drove me to write the book.
I mean, it tries to answer the question, like, why go to church at all, right? In a sense where there's actually the problem the church solves is not one that can be done by you, like, doing more, feeling more, but actually God coming and doing something for you, and that God doing something is retained when certain elements are retained, like the hearing of his word and
right.
The administration of his promises and the sacraments.
Right. It's the only framework that you can trust on from week to week to actually deliver the message of law and gospel. That's all we have. If the pastor's having a bad week, if he's just not generally a very astute pastor, which unfortunately we have plenty of, I think even in the Missouri Synod, it at least protects us. Oh, sorry. Should I not have said that? I don't have any authority in the Missouri Synod whatsoever,
so I can't
get in trouble.
Don't worry about it.
I already have nothing with what.
Could you just say present company excluded?
Present company excluded. Well, of course, of course.
You're like looking at
Ed's one of the Ed's one of the good guys here.
I'm crying over here. I'm bleeding. No, you know, David. One of the things I wanted to ask you is you quoted a bunch. You cited a bunch of really fascinating research, but one of the things that I got a chuckle out of, because it goes not only to the topic of ritual, but also the greater kind of societal discourse that we've had in the last year, when you talk about how we think our beliefs are formed and how they're actually formed. Would you speak to that a little bit? I thought that was fascinating.
Yeah, there is a lot of research that that's come out in particularly the field of psychology in the past 30-ish years, and Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky have been on the leading front of that, although there are a lot of other scholars that talk about the issues. And they make the point that belief is more like an involuntary reaction. Like, we tend to believe the first thing we hear and not really question it later on. It's because of something that he refers to as System 1 and System 2 thinking, that System 1 is the way we reason intuitively, right? We hear things, we generally believe them. System 2 should check it from an evidential standpoint. It should be critical and it should provide doubt. But he argues that System 2, well, he doesn't argue it. He shows this in experiments, that it's lazy. It's often very lazy and doesn't hold System 1 to account. So We believe generally the first thing we hear, and we become pretty biased from that standpoint on.
Yeah, you demonstrated pretty clearly how even when presented with irrefutable evidence, we don't like to give up what it is we've already clung to.
Right, right. Yeah. We dig down even deeper.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And then we'll find evidence that can support what it is that we originally came to believe.
This is the problem with talking to Dave. He refers to all these sources, and they're fascinating, and you end up spending or blowing $200 on Amazon on books in fields way outside.
Yeah, sorry about that.
I've already ordered a couple of things.
Don't you work at a university?
Yeah, they have a library. Right, Adam. I don't have that anymore, so I've got to blow it on Amazon.
Adam's they like, wait, I can use books. The library? That's not just for students?
I have used the library.
Okay.
So these are very recent books, kind of, sort of.
So yeah, these are maybe recent. A lot of these are recent. Yeah. No doubt. But yeah, that is, Ed, that's a fascinating subject all on its own.
Yeah.
The issue of knowledge and the nature and extent of human knowledge.
Yeah, I think this book would be terrific for, when we're talking about pastors and that continual struggle in pedagogy and understanding how people think and form their beliefs. I think this is an exceedingly useful book for pastors and laymen alike. I think it's really, because it addresses so much of the when the rubber meets the road kind of stuff.
Yeah, and I'm not suggesting some sort of postmodern despair of knowledge. We can certainly know things. We do all the time. But it's our knowledge is far less justified oftentimes than we think it is. We most of the time think that whatever we think is justified and it's it bears the weight of evidence, but a lot of the times it isn't. A lot of the times it can be shown that we've reasoned from certain biases that come into play. It can be corrected, but thinking involves effort, right? And the point that Kahneman is making is that system one is lazy and it usually wins the day, right? That intuitive, quick snap judgment type of thinking wins most of the time.
Is this perhaps the subject of your next book?
It is.
That's ooh. Awesome. Yeah.
A little teaser.
So to tie things into, mm-hmm. So the current series on the Thinking Fellows is we are just walking through the Book of Concord. We're going through the whole thing, although we're going out of order as they show up in the Book of Concord, and we're going order published, so we start with the Small Catechism. We're in the Large Catechism right now. We just read through the First and the Second Commandment, and as I was going through the book, the idea that one always has a God certainly pops up as a theme through here, mm-hmm. which is the echoing comment of Luther in the Large Catechism on
argument for all of our idols,
yes,
or against all of our idols.
It is, and to go to Ed's question, this is kind of where it leads, at least in this book, is that we struggle sometimes to come to warranted conclusions with things that we could verify, right? Things that it wouldn't be terribly difficult to verify, and we don't bother going that extra step of verifying. I mean, just think about what's happened in 2020. I suppose we could talk about all sorts of things that you think, oh my gosh, I mean, how did these things proliferate, and how do why do people believe what they do?
Yes.
But now take that to the religious realm, right? Where we do have a vested interest, we are sinful human beings, and above all, we really do worship ourselves. I mean, it's ourselves that matter more than anything, and that's where I'm suggesting that ritual comes to play. The word sacrament framework basically challenges that, and it causes us to enlarge our worldview.
Absolutely.
At least during the service, the worship service, right?
The whole thing is set up to change your curve.
Yes, yes. To take us from inside to outside.
Yeah, to drive you outside of yourself. Mm-hmm. This is in the postscript. You have a great section on the hidden and revealed God and the difference there, and
yes.
sort of what our mind does speculation-wise yep. with the hidden God. Plug for my other podcast, Luther's Outlaw God. The entire show is following Steve Paulson's book, Luther's Outlaw God, which is essentially a 3-volume series on speculation, proclamation, and the hidden and revealed God, and just really how nasty and how
prevalent it is for us to constantly be driving back towards speculating.
Right.
To be crafting God out of our imagination or out of the world into something that we can leverage for ourselves.
Or usually out of our preconceptions.
Right.
Of what he should be and yes. how he should deal with us.
Yeah, and that this happens in many ways. Very formally in scholasticism, right, which sets up presuppositions about how God has to work or who God is or what the end results have to be. And even now, everybody's got a system like this, whether it's highly sophisticated or extremely simple, that they are crafting God in their image.
And that's really, not that particular part, but that's really what modern research has shown. I mean, it's hard to question it at this point because it's so overwhelming, the research is that our minds are really factories for jumping to conclusions. And we love a coherent story more than anything, and we don't feel comfortable with inconsistencies, and so our minds will craft a tight,
internally
coherent story.
Argument,
yep. And we do this in normal things, right? Can you imagine how that extends in the religious realm, where we don't have the same sort of access to things that should correct us.
Yeah, so it's very difficult to convince somebody that's constructed a quote-unquote internally coherent argument
right.
that they think is all tied up and neat and clean, that perhaps some of their premises don't match the external evidence.
Right.
Even that's difficult to do something politically. It's difficult to do in your marriage. It's different. Think of how hard it is to do.
Well, and the problem is it usually is one of the starting premise.
Well, think about how difficult it is to do with something that in our society we're taught is just a personal belief. That it really, your belief about God doesn't necessarily have to correspond to actual truth in any way, shape, or form, because it's just personal, right? It just has to do with you. That's it. Don't force it on me. I won't force mine on you. It just has to do with you. And so you start making claims that are more than that, that are actually truth claims, whether it's apologetic truth claims about the truth of Christianity, or it's a truth claim about how one interacts with this God and how this God interacts with, with you.
Right.
Exceptionally difficult. I mean, I see large swaths of this book as an argument for making sure that if you're going to attempt that task, that you sort of have all guns firing in the right direction. That you're going to attempt the task of arguing that theology is for proclamation, right? And that the proclamation needs to be Christ for you proclamation. Mm-hmm. If you're going to start arguing for the truth claims, the biblical truth claims regarding Christ, if you're going to start all of those things and you're going to ask people to come on a Sunday morning and encounter those, better to have all guns firing in the same direction and that your liturgical life be on that same page too, that it be word and sacrament and biblical. Why not have everything going for you if you're making, claims that are so anti-cultural?
Right. Yep.
Oh, great, guys.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to end it.
Well, you did. I mean, we're just at about time. We only have a couple of minutes left. And so unless there's something somebody wants to sneak in before we go, is there anything you want to make sure people know that we didn't hit before we asked them to hit the buy button?
No, I think that probably the most important part is that the book is really a reaction to popular culture. Right, it's probably as much I'm probably as much of a cultural critic as anything else in the book. And the first part of the book kind of sets that up, and then that's really the direction I'm facing, right? Because American Christianity has become assimilated into popular culture. They love entertainment as much as anything, as much as your TV, even your news programming is focused on entertainment.
And then even
and confirming biases.
And confirming biases, right.
Yeah. Right. We pick which news we watch based on which biases we want confirmed.
Exactly.
And then,
is that why you watch MSNBC?
Yeah. Ardently avoid all others. Wow.
Swinging a miss.
I mean, American Christianity is so much of a cultural force that it is its own voter demographic
for
politicians to go after. Yeah. It is something mimic and imitate.
mimicked and imitated on TV, maybe even attacked in certain ways, right? And by stereotypes, which in a large part can be found to be true and things like this. And so, it's a big force. And it's a force that when you look at it as a Christian in America, oftentimes if you're liturgical or historical church, you don't recognize yourself in this, this picture out there of that. And the question is why? Is there an answer to that to Christians who sort of are seemingly getting clowned by popular culture all the time by this?
Right. I think Christianity, the popular form of Christianity, has lost its way, and of course that happened early in the 19th century with the revivalists. Nothing has really changed much from their framework of worship. But all I'm suggesting is that we may have gone that direction too quickly, because what we've lost is the only legitimate framework for worship that we hear instituted by Christ himself, and we see the same pattern flow in the early church. And we risk losing the message of the gospel because we've lifted the framework out of the service. There's nothing there to guarantee that it's going to be there.
Right. Yeah. Well, great. The book is In Defense of Christian Ritual, The Case for a Biblical Pattern of Worship. You can find it at shop.1517.org or at Amazon. I hear great things about the 1517 shop. If you buy multiple books there, you can get free shipping like you do on Amazon. Shipping's fast and friendly, even, I hear.
Get a little handwritten
note
saying thank you for your
purchase. So, and oftentimes...
Take that, Bezos.
Because book production has been slowed in 2020 and things like that. Print runs are more limited. Sometimes we have much more stock than Amazon does at any given point. So if it says back ordered or something like that on Amazon, you can almost certainly get it that day at shop.1517.org. All right. Thanks for listening to this episode. We will catch you next time. Bye.